69 of the Survival Podcast. Seems like just yesterday I was doing episode 69. Now we're at 3869. It's been a minute. My guest and I were talking about that's Kyle Beaver. He's going to be on with us in a moment. I'm wondering if this dude's like walking, you know, a couple decades in my past over top of me or something. He's in Pennsylvania. He's got a farm called 10 Mile Mushroom Farm. I got a farm called 9 Mile Farm. I'm from Pennsylvania. Kind of serendipity there, but we're going to be talking about mushrooms today. And I know you're thinking, Jack, you've talked about mushrooms a lot. I know how to grow a mushroom now if I want to. We're going to come at this in a different way today, more from the entrepreneurial side. This gentleman started out a very small mushroom operation. I think about $300 invested in it, if I remember right. Checking my notes. Yeah, $300. And he now has a 70-acre farm. And he was able to do that by building a profitable business and then scaling that business to a degree and doing some things with it to scale revenue, and then being able to go to the USDA option and say, hey, I want a loan to buy a farm. And they said, okay. And that kind of, in fact, he's got a 70-acre farm that started with a $300 mushroom tent. And I want you guys to listen today, because many of you guys, and we'll dig into this with him when we bring him on here in a minute, you may not be doing mushrooms, but there's a lot of you doing kind of these small businesses that can scale in various ways that you might be able to take the same blueprint, even if you're not in the mushroom footprint, if that makes sense. There's quite a few of you guys out there that are doing really well. For instance, hey, Mr. John Dowie, with something like microgreens. I don't see a single reason that this blueprint could not be applied. It might take some creativity and some things. I was reading up on our guest's journey a little bit before the show today, and there were some things he did that we'll talk about, like scaling the business in the first place so there's enough revenue to warrant the loan. But I can think of various ways that can be done. So we'll be talking about that in a moment. And for a lot of you, I mean, this is your dream. This is what you want. You want that farm that's also a revenue stream. And generally, the biggest problem we have is a lack of capital. And I am a big anti-debt guy, but when I'm an anti-debt guy, I mean that I'm an anti-credit card debt guy. I am not anti-debt in of itself. Debt is a leverage tool. And leverage, when applied properly, can do more work than if you don't have the lever. So we're going to be talking about a bunch of stuff today. Before we do that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is Start 9, where you can get your own absolutely 100% you control it privacy embassy server. You can do a lot of cool stuff on it. I just had Jesse Markowitz on a couple of weeks ago. If you haven't heard that show, go listen to all the cool things that you can do with Start 9 and all the cool things that are just about to be added. This is an amazing tool. It lets you take complete and total sovereignty over your data and your ability to access it. It lets you communicate with people that you want to with encryption that, people say it's military grade. It's better than military grade. All right. If you're ever in the military, military grade doesn't mean as much to you as it does to a lot of people. You know what I'm talking about. It is absolutely an incredible tool. It is not that hard to use. If you can install apps on a smartphone and use apps on a smartphone, then you can do this. Check them out today, start9.com. And remember, if you're an MSB member, your discount that they give you as an MSB member will pay for your membership for like 3 years. And if you use the fold card and stack Bitcoin, you can get like another 9% off by going the gift card route through through Fold. So check them out today. Again, they've been a long-term sponsor, been with us long enough that when they started out with us, COVID wasn't a thing that people even knew the name of yet. Next up today, Biltong USA, Anton, the king of Biltong. This guy makes some of the best Biltong I've ever eaten. He also makes these Biltong sticks that I didn't even know existed before I met him. They're fantastic. The Drew Wars dry sausages are great. He's got new ones now with peri peri pepper in them. But if you like a little bit of heat to go along with your not so sweet, you want to give those things a try. He does a discount for MSB members. And he's another guy who's been with us since right before COVID is when we first really connected. And he built this business right in the middle of the debacle that COVID caused. He had opened up a small restaurant. Uh-oh. That's a problem, even in Texas at the very beginning. And so he built out his little store, and he started thinking about, what can I make money on that I can ship? Biltong was an answer to that, along with some other stuff that he makes himself and some really cool stuff he imports. Check him out today at BiltongUSA.com. And again, remember, he does give you a discount if you are a member. With that, I want to bring our special guest on, Kyle Beaver. Kyle, welcome to the show, man.
Jack, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
I'm really happy to have you on, man. When I got your app, I'm like, okay, another mushroom guy. And I've got mushrooms growing. You can't see them. They're right here.
Awesome.
I've got a 2-gallon bucket in my boom room that just fruited an ass load of golden oysters that I got to harvest before they start to go off.
Nice. So you have some experience.
Yeah. So I like growing mushrooms. It's fun. Got some blue oysters in there as well. And I every morning I throw coffee into a bucket that propagates spawn. So I like mushrooms, but I'll tell you what else I like. I like good business models. And I'm not going to go into the mushroom business personally as a for-profit, but I see it as a great leaping off point. What actually made you go this route, though? I don't think you're probably born into a family that grew mushrooms every day or something like that. And at some point, I guess you figured out, I want to grow something. I want to build a business. I want to do something. What was the driving force behind the decision?
Yeah, I mean, before I got into specialty mushrooms, specialty crops, I was working for a little carny outfit, mom and pop deal, and they were traveling and they had a super niche product. They were doing stuffed pretzels. And I saw how they had such a crazy following driving hours to get these stuffed pretzels. So that was kind of a, mostly summer type job. I had the winters off. So I was looking for something to do that, could just be a little bit of a side gig, side business, maybe just a little hustle. And I just was researching little things that were niche. And my final search was things to do with small amounts of space. And the specialty mushroom growing page came up, and I've always been into plants, fungi, biology. And after I saw this page, it was like a UK page, which was even the weirdest part, because it wasn't anything that was relevant to what was going on around me. But I was quickly like, nobody's doing this. I've never seen these mushrooms before. So that's where the small investment came in. I grew some blue oysters. And after I cooked them up, dude, I was like, this is something special. These are different. These are not your ordinary mushrooms. And then from after that point, I was kind of off to the races with it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that did it for me with the oysters wasn't just how easy they were, but how easy they were to propagate. When I found out I could cut a stem open, pluck out some mycelium, and then colonize something, and then grow that out, and then make a mushroom out of it, and basically I had this never-ending mushroom capability.
Yes.
Like, this is way too easy not to do it.
It's the unlimited mushroom hack.
Yeah.
And, there's a fine line between it. Like, growing for personal use, you can grow on your homestead for your family all day long.
Yeah.
In various different methods, we do more of a commercial method here on our farm just because it's just a little bit more consistent. But with the toilet paper rolls, whatever. I mean,
the way I look at it for a home grower is if I have a crop that goes wrong, it's probably one block or one culture that I did, and I feed it to the worms and they're happy and everything's good. If you're a commercial grower, that could be a whole lot, right? That could be a week's worth of production that you lose. So you have to use a little more tight control.
And that's typically how it happens. Usually you'll lose a whole batch of week's worth or a whole full run at a time just because maybe one of your parameters are off here or there. So yeah, it is farming still at the end of the day, but this is a 365 year round indoor crop, and that's the beauty of it. And that's what was interesting to me was like, okay, there's lots of other avenues other than just selling the fresh mushrooms first off. But there's also the year-round aspect where, like, okay, this could maybe be a full-time gig.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, in some ways, it's not a manufacturing process, but it functions like one. Really there was a while I was doing this project on YouTube where I was making mead every week, and I was doing a mead of the week, and I was making a batch every week. And what I ended up doing was in a 15-minute cycle, I could bottle a batch. I was just doing little 1-gallon batches. I could bottle a batch, so five basically wine bottles of mead, and I could rack a batch into a secondary fermenter, and then I could brew a batch. And once I had enough in the pipeline for one to be coming out every week, I could spend 15 minutes a week and produce a gallon of mead. Now, it didn't start out that way, but it had that ongoing manufacturing capability once the pipeline was full. And what I love about what you guys do with mushroom farming is it's kind of the same theory, and then you can scale the volume that comes out the other end, but you can know each week I'm going to be able to produce X amount of lion's mane, X amount of blue oyster, X amount of, you know, chestnut, or whatever it is you're growing. And that gives you stability, and it also levels cash flow, which for agricultural business, most agricultural business do not have, you know, leveled out cash flow in them. There takes a lot of discipline. In fact, a lot of the debt structure of our country, and I'm not talking about the good debt that you and I are about to talk about, but a lot of the debt structure in our country goes back to financing farmers because they never had the money to get the crop in the ground in the beginning of the year. They needed like to be able to subsist until harvest. And, you know, somehow when you run that model, it gets really hard to get ahead.
Yeah, it's bad, Jack. I mean, I think the U.S. Corn Association has said that I think it's 80 or 90% of row crop farmers were in the negative last year. And that's just due to input costs. It's insane. You know, this is on their site saying that growing an acre of corn is a negative $150 net. I mean, this is like
the organization designed to get more people to do it. That how's that for, you know, incentive? Hey, join us and lose $150 an acre every year.
Yeah, it's insane. And agriculture itself has bred this real, like, you know, almost like social system of needing to be reimbursed by the government. And I think it's led to this ultimate thing where people want to grow food, but they don't think about it as a business. They don't think about it as how am I really going to support myself other than getting subsidies? You know, and that's what's so cool about mushrooms. The margins are out of this world compared to row cropping.
Sure.
You know, so well, off of a block that you can buy for $10, you can yield anywhere between $40 to $60 of gross revenue. And there's, you know, so there's real profit there. But yeah, absolutely. It's insane.
So that actually merges well with my next question. You know, we talk a lot about self-reliance here. What does self-reliance mean to you beyond just growing some of your own food?
Yeah, self-reliance. Yeah, it's I think it has to be a full picture thing when you're thinking about, especially if right now, if you're going to invest into property, you're going to invest into all this stuff. More than likely, you want self-reliance on a total, you know, holistic approach, you know. So for me, that means solar, the whole nine, battery backup, you know, other options when it comes to water, having, you know, a 10-year garden, stored seeds, all that kind of stuff, you know, quote unquote, the real prepping deal. And I mean, I think it only makes sense. There's no point in really doing it half-assed, because if you ever really do need it, you're going to be wishing that you had it. So when it comes to the farm itself, I mean, really getting off the grid is something we're working on right now. We're working with an awesome solar company. It's the best we can do. You know, I'd love to do something different, but it's a really great deal. And with the other government incentives and some grants and other things that you can obtain as a small farm, you're virtually paying nothing out of pocket, which is crazy. I'm still in the process. I'm still learning about it. But essentially how it works is the tax credit from the federal government pays for half of the incentives, which that's been the case for a long time. And the other half is taken care of by a state grant. And how this company works, they'll actually write the grant for you with a deposit. If you don't get the grant, you don't go forward with the process. So there's almost no risk to you. So that's one aspect of what we're trying to do as far as the holistic approach. And also other streams of revenue here, you know, I don't think farms these days can quote unquote survive with just one stream of revenue, you know, so we're taking that agritourism route here. We have some Airbnbs. We have all the coal strippings here in Pennsylvania. We're about 10 minutes from them. So there's a large off-road community now coming in. So we live 10 minutes from a large, one of the world's largest free admission amusement parks. So, you know, we're adding all of these little things in, and really that's what survival is all about. I think where we're at right now, it used to be different. I think in the 80s, you could grow corn in the 70s and do decent and be able to actually buy and purchase land. But I actually talked to property came up for sale here next to me last week, and I'm talking to Farm Credit about figuring out a way to get it. And his words were, you pretty much are not going to be able to purchase ag land doing ag. It's insane. It's just insane. So that's, you know, that comes back to purchasing the 70 acres that I bought.
Yeah.
You know, I almost want to start emphasizing a little bit more, because people have been commenting on all of our socials, you know, check us out on Instagram, we're Grow Much More. And we talk about this land acquisition a lot, and people are like, well, we can't pay 10K for an acre for farmland. And it's like, dude, yeah, that's right. We're past that point. Find something that's workable and make it happen. We're turning my property back into ag land. It was timbered. You know, it has some real problem with invasive species. We're taking care of it, you know, and that's the reality of the situation. You're not going to buy pristine farmland for $3,000 an acre, but you can find other great properties that have a lot going on for them for cheap.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And that right now to me is where opportunity actually exists. That's where it lives. Rich people buy a house that's perfectly built and remodeled, right? With four floors and 57 bedrooms or whatever does it for them, and travertine tiles and golden toilets or whatever. And then regular people, you know, especially if you go back about 25 years, would go out and look for a house that's good structurally, and then you would fix it up and make it what you wanted it to be. That way you could actually afford to buy a house that was big enough for your family versus going to try to buy a perfect house. And land is in many ways actually a bit easier to rehabilitate than an effed up house. Like a really effed up house, like sometimes – what does this house need? Well, it needs 5 gallons of gasoline and a match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there are, and I know the part of Pennsylvania you're talking about too, because I grew up in Schuylkill County.
Yeah, we're just north of Schuylkill County.
Yeah. Like when you're talking about coal strip mines and stuff like that, I'm like, I wonder if he knows about the Blackwood Buggy Festival that was around back when I was in high school.
I haven't heard of it, but I'm sure it's the makings of all of this that's going on.
It's kind of like what you're talking about. It was a big thing. It was informal, and it happened once a year in the summer, and there'd be about 30,000 people out there, and about 15,000 of the 30,000 would be teenagers.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, they'd send like a state trooper out there to check on things, and he'd come up over the hill, and you're looking at 30,000 people and one dude with a cherry on the top of his car. You just see him 3-point turn and leave. Like, I'm not doing this shit. So yeah, it's, and there's a lot of land up there that desperately needs rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking there's probably some grants specifically to rehabilitate the land. Right. So like, and that's the thing about these government programs. They can be very predatory, but when they allow you to do the thing you want to do anyway, that's a different situation. And probably the least predatory government body that does things in the real world today is NRCS.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've had several people from NRCS on talk about some of the things they do, and I'm like, I kind of hate the state, but I don't hate you. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, they do some really good stuff. Like, I've had people get upset because, you know, I've advocated things like high tunnel grants and we're supposed to be all libertarian and whatever. Like, man, until you get 100% of the money they've taken from you across your life back, get anything you can as long as it works for what you're trying to do.
Absolutely. You know? And, you know, my whole motto is, you know, kind of use the government to get up over the government if you can. You know, everyone else is doing it. These billionaires are doing it. Why are you not going to take advantage of the things that are present to you as just a common person and use it to your advantage? I mean, it's silly to say, oh, I'm not going to take that. I'd rather pay 10% interest from the bank. Well, first off, the bank isn't going to give you this money. Second off, the government's going to back you on a 40-year mortgage for the lowest possible interest rate you're going to find. Our 70 acres here, we have an 8,000 square foot warehouse where I live here in a second story mezzanine. We pay $1,900 a month for our mortgage. It's 3%. We got in right after COVID, you know, and right now it's only up to 5%. So like it's nothing compared to what you would pay from Farm Credit or anywhere else.
Yeah.
And it's 0% down. That's literally awful. Up to $600K. So I did all the work here myself. I built everything myself just because I wasn't going to be able to do all this for under $600K by myself, put the building up. And
so that's the land, the building, the infrastructure.
That's everything. Yeah, that's everything. So, but it's still feasible, you know, you're right. You got to be in the right area. Like here in Pennsylvania, the land can be found for cheap. Particularly, you know, stuff that's trading hands in this farmland transition. You know, there's a lot of wooded land connected to existing farms that's being broken up. And the property here that we found, I just did my research on it. It wasn't on the regular MLS. It was on like Whitetail Properties. I'm a big hunter. You know, I'm a big hunter, and it wasn't listed. There wasn't a sign. There wasn't anything. I did some research and, you know, come to find this woman probably actually never laid eyes on this property. She had inherited it. She, you know, she didn't know anything about it. She had it timber cut. So that was my end. I'm like, okay, now we can actually play ball.
So she inherits it. She goes to somebody. What do I do with it? They say, well, we'll buy the timber from you and then sell the dirt. And
yeah,
so she had no emotional connection to it whatsoever. She just wanted to turn a piece of land that was gifted to her in inheritance into money.
Yeah, she was retired. She just needed money. You know, that was it. And, you know, it was apparent that she was willing to talk after I came in with a really super low offer to begin with, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I made 5 offers, but that's what it's going to take. You know, if you really want to get something that's you have a dream for, it's doable. You just can't be afraid of getting people to say no.
Yeah. You know, I've bought quite a bit of real estate in my life, and I've never not had an opportunity to make a second offer if the first one was turned down for being too low. I've never had anybody like, that's so low, I'll never talk to you again. I've never had that happen.
Nope.
I have figured out, though, that if you offer too much and they say yes, you're kind of screwed. So it always pays to go in kind of hardball from the beginning. You know?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I have my real estate license here now because of that situation.
Oh, wow.
And so I see it all the time. You know, people are willing to negotiate. And homes here land in general is not moving. Everything's going to auction right now because interest rates are high. People will still get on that frantic auction frenzy, but that's not where you're going to find something to do what we're talking about here, to start a life and build the kind of dream homestead that you want.
There's diamonds. You just got to find them first. Let's dig back into mushrooms a bit. I know one of your kind of mainstay mushrooms is lion's mane, and mushrooms produce food and medicine. How does lion's mane fit into what you're doing and the self-reliance mindset beyond just income?
Yeah. Lion's mane, it's like this brain longevity. I'm sure a lot of you have heard of it. It's now been scientifically proven to help reconnect synapses in your brain, get your brain to fire on different neural networks that it's kind of maybe been lacking on, or where you've lost some of that connectivity. It's a really special thing, and it's been proven to have some effects on Lyme's disease as well, which I don't know if you guys got the Lone Star tick where you're at, but we got pretty much all of them now, and they are really bad. And we've had some customers using our tinctures and medicinal stuff who have said this is the only thing that really helps with my Lyme symptoms.
Oh, wow.
Which is crazy because I didn't hear of that until after the fact and they were using it. But yeah, the mushrooms in of themselves are just, they're a great substitute for nearly any meat product that you're looking for. You know, you're looking to eat a little bit healthier, a little less cholesterol. The lion's mane in of themselves are, they're like crab. You just peel them apart and they make a great crab, shrimp, and or chicken kind of, you know, foe or whatever. They're super interesting. We love buffalo chicken dip with them. That's my number one.
Yeah, that can't be bad. What I figured out with those right away is to cook the moisture out of them and compress them. And they kind of fit that kind of meat substitute thing well, but I'll eat all the meat and then some more. I'm not doing it because I want to substitute it for meat. I'm doing it because it tastes good. And mm-hmm. I've also figured out, like, I do some things with, like, it's kind of hard to grow king oyster well all the time. But it turns out if you maybe let there be a little bit more CO2 in a grow tent than there's supposed to be, but not too much, blue oysters get those big-ass stems.
They do.
And it's mm-hmm. crazy. And then when you cut them up in discs and cook them with butter and stuff, they kind of taste like a scallop. And that means I can grow something that tastes like a scallop. Again, I'm not opposed to killing a shellfish and eating it. I just can't grow those here. Like, they don't do well in 100-degree heat where there's no salt water. And what it would take to do it, I can't even begin to put my head around it. And the way that different fungi can be used is I don't even think we've begun to even figure out what we can do with it. I think even, like, the genius mind of someone like Paul Stamets or something, like, we've scratched maybe 0.5% of what the potential is.
Yeah, and the mystery is what's so fun about it, you know?
Yeah.
The not knowing, and that's quite frankly how the business is. It's like something's happened within cultivation that you have no idea as to what's going on.
Yeah.
But we do grow a hybrid. It's the first hybrid specialty mushroom. It's called a black king oyster. So those are a cross between the blue oyster and king oysters, supposedly from Asia somewhere where they're mm-hmm. a little bit more biologically advanced at crossing these spores and creating hybrids. But they grow like an oyster, but they have that nice fat stem like a king oyster. They're delicious. They're my favorite, and they're super high yielding. I mean, off a 10-pound block, you're getting like three pounds easily.
I might have to order some of those from you because that'd be an interesting thing to play with and see how they come out. I keep kicking around the idea of doing a grow out for my fall workshop and providing mushrooms for people to eat. The problem is, for an amateur guy like me with a single small tent system, I basically have to stuff it full to feed that many people. We're talking about 80 people. Mm-hmm. And then getting them all to fruit at the right time and in the timeline where they don't go off by the time you're ready to cook them could be complicated.
But it really is. And that's why it's like you're almost better off just growing like X amount every week, because it's tough to do and just have them ready when you want. The mystery of the mushrooms, again, prevails.
Well, another thing about the place where you live, where I grew up, is mushroom foraging is really a common thing up there. I grew up foraging mushrooms, anything from spongies to hen of the woods, chicken of the woods, you know, all of them. And the thing was, like, you didn't know when you were going to find and how much you were going to find. Cause it was kind of like, well, I went out today and I found a bunch of mushrooms, so now we're eating mushrooms this week. And for a home grower, I think that's kind of the way to go. Like, sometimes I'll throw a block in there and it'll pin in 2 days and it'll fruit in three. And sometimes it'll take, you know, a week and a half for a block that looks identical in the same strain to fruit. And so I just kind of look at it when I walk in the morning, go, oh, it's pinning, and I move it up higher on the shelf, and I know it's going to fruit then either tomorrow or the next day. Okay, now I'm eating mushrooms. And I think for the home grower, that's a pretty good way to go. You guys in the commercial space, you get very scientific with it, and you probably also develop things like that one's not going to fruit as fast as everybody else in the batch or something. And somebody asks you, like, well, how do you know that? You go, I just do.
That's kind of how it is. It's just experience with a lot of these things, you know, and there's always things going wrong and awry. It's nothing that's dead set by any means. You just have to kind of go with the flow, and that's what keeps it exciting, because sometimes you'll inoculate some substrate and it'll get a real slow jump, and there's just a tiny bit of mycelium slowly growing off of the grain. And you know, at that point, what we do is we re-break and distribute the spawn. If you're home growing, you may not care to do that, and it's just going to take another 3 or 4 weeks, you know.
I've put stuff in there and gone, I don't even think that was my fruit. You walk back in the next day, and like lion's mane will do that a lot of times. Like, and also there it is. Like, where did you come from? Like, you know, like, where did you show up from? You got somebody showing up there for you right now.
This is my deaf cat, Jerry. He's a lover.
Almost all deaf cats are white.
Yep. He has that heterochromia. So yeah, eyes are different colors.
We had a Duluth calico that was primarily white. She was like that. I remember telling the vet one time, I said, the new vet, she's like, she's deaf. And she's like, no, she's not. And I went up behind her and just slapped my hands together right behind her head as hard as I could. And she could kind of like, something happened, but I don't know what it is.
And a loop for the world.
Yeah. She goes, oh, well, that's okay. Yeah, I know it's okay. But let's talk a little bit more about your route, like using USDA loans and looking at that differently.
Definitely.
You said in your application on the show that basically you don't look at a loan the way a conventional person does as something to avoid, more as access rather than debt. And I think that's a good way to look at it. We're looking at money as capital in a type of business rather than just debt to buy something that's going to be worthless before the debt's paid off.
Well, yeah. And Jack, you got to look at it this way. It's like, if I wasn't here doing this, I would be renting a house somewhere for almost the same amount of money. I would have all kinds of expenses. I would be driving to work. It's the same thing, you know, whether or not my business does great or not, if I can pay the bills, I'm still in a better off spot because we're creating equity here.
Yeah.
So I'm now taking this property and transforming it into something that's, you know, we have the $600,000 in debt. We're about to have it reappraised, and it's going to reappraise for double that. The properties are selling for, like I said, $10,000 an acre.
Yeah.
You know, so we almost off the bat here are going to have $500,000-$600,000 in equity just from making it happen on our own and just building the building this way. So I think that's what's going to unlock a lot of future endeavors for us as far as expansion, as far as doing some more of these direct to consumer type of things, whereas we've been mostly a wholesale business up until this point. So yeah, it's great to hear that you're a home grower, because that's like over the years, I've been doing it 10 years. I'm just learning that so many people just are just starting out, and they have, you know, you get in the mushroom community and people want to hear the scientific name and all of this stuff, when in reality, most people don't even really know what an oyster mushroom is, you know, so you got to keep it low level sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people that just look at, I'll go to the grocery store and $6 buys me like 3 ounces of these crappy blue oysters that aren't that great because they've been in that cellophane for 3 weeks. Or, you know, my other option is buttons or something. And the fact that I can grow cool mushrooms. And then for me, it was a little bit different. Like, I really never thought about when I was a young guy doing this, because I grew up in central PA and there was just mushroom season. There was a spring mushroom season. There's a fall mushroom season. Mm-hmm. And mushrooms were just something we went out and we got, and we would either blanch and freeze or dry, or, you know, my grandmother would integrate some of them into like her chow chow relish and stuff like that. So it was just a product of the land. So when I got down here and, you know, kind of like started building out this little homestead and all, I'm like, I should have some mushrooms here. So you do some research and they're like, well, just inoculate your garden with King Strophoria.
Mm-hmm.
okay, yeah, that would work really good if I lived like 200 miles north of here.
Yeah, but you're so, dry.
You know, generally in the, like this year's different. I probably could grow them in the summer this year. It's hot, but it's humid. Generally in the summer here, you know, don't sneeze too hard. You'll start a grass fire. I mean, that's how dry it is. And you're not growing much mushrooms in this environment. Even in our fall and spring, there's a very narrow window of the stuff you really want to eat is going to do well here. And so I'm like, well, if I'm going to do this, I have to figure out how to do this inside. Mm-hmm. And I'm even doing things now that are kind of unconventional. Like I have about a 10-gallon tub in my grow tent right now that's full of soil because I'm doing King Strophoria inside. Oh. Right. And you ain't going to grow King Strophoria without soil. It doesn't fruit off a block. Right. Nope. And I'm like, I wonder if this can be done. Well, turns out it can be done. And I think that's we're going to have this kind of collaboration, I think, between the home grower hobbyist and the commercial grower to figure out all the things we can do.
Absolutely. And that's where we're at right now. That's like that's exactly where the trajectory of the business is going. Like we were doing the wholesale stuff. And really what we do is we sell the blocks on a wholesale level in quantities to other farms across the country. So we're shipping the blocks to other people who are making their living off of fruiting the blocks. So now with this whole realization that people are beginners, we've started an actual grow club where we're doing subscription blocks in smaller quantities to people's houses, and they're able to grow them indoors and do from a small thing to kind of build up and get to a point where maybe they could have a business out of it. And that's what's so cool about going back to the USDA loan. The USDA only requires to be considered a farm to sell $1,000 a year. Some people argue that point, but that's what I found. It's 10,000 or 1,000. I found 1,000 on most of my searches, and there's really no other stipulations than having to sell $1,000 worth of farm products produced on your property. Now, you're not going to qualify for the $600,000 for that.
No.
But when we qualified, we were only doing like $60,000 a year. We were doing farmers markets. This was prior to scaling up and actually becoming a wholesale distributor. This was the point where we were just still grinding it out, doing farmers markets, and hadn't made really an online presence yet.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I think people need to understand there's a difference between getting a loan like he's talking about and having land zoned agricultural. Those have different requirements. Like I'll never have a zoned piece of ag land here on my property because it's only 3 acres. And we have a minimum acreage, unless they change it. But right now we have a minimum acreage in Texas of 5 acres to be considered zoned ag. It doesn't mean that I can't run a farm. It doesn't mean I can't get an agricultural loan. Those are different worlds.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people buy a piece of land, use an ag loan to buy it, convert it over, and then get it zoned agricultural in the future. Like there's multiple paths to the same place.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And that's the beauty of indoor growing. I mean, microgreens and mushrooms are the things that you're going to want to focus on if you want to start some sort of indoor cultivation that you could really make this a possible reality. And about my first year into this is when I learned about the USDA beginning farmer and rancher loan. And after I learned about that, I was like, okay, this is what I'm doing. This is my only opportunity. So you just got to make it work. You just need a small indoor space. I mean, I was renting a barn for my parents. It was real tiny. And then it overtook kind of into the basement of their house for some time. And, you know, it was just a total ramshackle type of deal. But super grateful I had the opportunity to at least get started, you know.
Yeah, I would say microgreens, mushrooms. And the other thing I would talk to say that you might be able to pull this off with is, especially going the hydroponic route, doing like baby greens, high-end salad greens, things like that. All three of those not only lend themselves to interior cultivation actually gives you a tremendous amount of advantage because they're quick term, high production crops that when you can dial in parameters, specifically temperature, humidity, et cetera, you can maximize production. And when you go into the hydroponic world, then you can start you know, micromanaging nutrients, and then you can also automate a lot of that. And I'm just betting the mushroom industry is tied into a lot of automation as well at this point.
Definitely.
And by doing that, you gain a great deal of control. And again, the hardest part I feel about being a farmer in the conventional sense is no matter what you're growing, the time between the capital investment and the capital extraction is difficult to manage, you know, especially in a business that routinely has very expensive shit break. Right. So like it'll be right in the middle of that cycle where I'm the furthest from planting and the furthest from harvesting possible that, you know, a $50,000 piece of hydraulics will break.
Oh, yeah.
Right. That's the kind of stuff that happens to farmers on a daily basis. And you don't have a $50,000 piece of hydraulics to break, you know, in the kind of situations that we're talking about, especially early on when you're small, before you can really afford to like, OK, I got to invest in this.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, when you're small in those first like 3 to 5 years, it's really pertinent to get that cash flow up. And that's kind of what our programs are focused on, and helping other farmers understand how to start small, scale up, eventually get this land pretty much just with like an A to Z mushroom farm start package, right? You know, it following the exact steps that I had taken, except trying to help people cut out all of the mistakes in the years of learning, you know.
And there's so much value in that. I had an old mentor way back in my sales days. So I was probably in my late 20s at this point. And I was like a hotshot sales guy. I was knocking down big money. And this company recruited me. And I went out to learn from this guy. And this dude was named Frank Madron. And he was, in his own words, a North Carolina redneck that grew up without shoes that now has a Harvard MBA. That's a dangerous man. So he sets a trap for me on one of his talks with me. And he says, Jack, do you think it's better to learn from experience than learn from somebody that already knows? And I'm like, well, if you pin me back on that, you don't let me say both. I'm going to say learn on your own. And he said, yeah, I know how you came up. So I knew you're going to answer that. He goes, but how would you feel if I was your surgeon? And I'm about to perform a really difficult operation on you. And right before they put the mask on your face, I lean over and go, don't worry, I'm self-taught. And I'm like, oh, I see.
Yep. And that's pretty much it. And that's been my realization, you know, that so many people are beginners. There's no information out there that's really broken down. There's tons of information about growing mushrooms, about all of this stuff I'm talking about, but nothing's laid out in an organized fashion to where it makes sense. And I was like, man, I just got to put this together so that people can see the actual path forward and what it looks like, you know? So now my philosophy, and this is what I would have hoped to have happened when I started, was focusing more on like the sales and marketing and getting our name out there sooner. You know, we grew up in a real time when the specialty mushroom industry is still in its infant stages. So we were able to ride out on that kind of organic wave for a little bit. And then it's like, okay, you know, we have to expand a little bit if we want this to continue to grow. And that's what we want for everybody, you know, to have a solid footing to where you're not running around not knowing how to sell to restaurants. It's just imperative.
Yeah, because I think there is a big problem in this space. And I don't even mean mushrooms. I mean growing, producing. And I don't care if it's plants. I don't care if it's fungi. I don't care if it's chickens or cattle or whatever. People think that the most important part is being able to produce. It's an important part. I'll give you that. Because if you don't produce anything, you have nothing to sell. You have no revenue. You're out of business, right? However, you will figure that out. Anybody that tries long enough will figure out how to tractor chickens or grow mushrooms or use hydroponics to grow baby greens or whatever. But if you can't sell it, all you have is a real expensive inventory that's either going to rot or eat you into the poorhouse of its animals, right? Like there's an old saying, like, and it's about personal improvement, but it's like once you're ripe, you begin to rot. Right. So you want to stay green, because as long as you're growing, you're living. And once you're ripe, you begin to die. Well, that's an observation of that's what happens. There's a point where you look at that apple on the tree and you either pick it and do something with it or it's worm food.
Yeah.
And that is going to hit the producer. And like I said, if you have sheep or something, like there's a point where you have over, you know, very expensive pets if you can't move the product. So I'm glad that you focus on that when it comes to helping others.
It's funny. Yeah. I mean, just in the last couple of weeks, we're going through just kind of clearing out some of the people that we've been following on Instagram. And literally, I mean, we only are following maybe 3,000 people, but we're deleting hundreds, literally hundreds of farms who were growing mushrooms and kind of just fell off. People who started a venture and they just didn't make it. And you know, the number one thing that we've diagnosed is people are just not sure how to make sales. They're not sure how to market themselves. They're so caught up in doing all of the processes of being a mycologist.
Yeah.
They forget about running a business. And that's kind of where our whole business has grown from, is doing all of that work, all those steps you were talking about earlier, the spawn production, the culture work, all of that stuff, cutting that out so people can just focus on fruiting mushrooms and selling them at their local markets.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Talk a little bit about what it feels like. Like, you, like me, had a job. I could tell just by talking to you. Like, you didn't just come out of the egg and start growing mushrooms for a living, right? So you had a job, you had a paycheck. And even like, you know, when I was employed, I had a good paycheck, but even to the point where, but right about the time I started this, I was actually a co-owner in the holding company that owned all the companies that I also had ownership in. So I had ownership, but I still answered to a board. I still got a W-2 paycheck. And when I started building this completely and totally independent of anybody else, that changed a lot of things in the world for me. And it's, the reason I like to talk about it isn't to brag or anything. It's to inspire other people. Like, this is worth doing. Like, I'm working on some new things for a show in the future right now called Pillars of Liberty. And one of those pillars is income that's not tied to somebody else's choice.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it like to go from a W-2 employee to really calling the shots? What was that transformation like for you?
It business in of itself is the best self-improvement program you are ever going to get into. I mean, it pays dividends in so many ways. Then when you stack mentorship, like you were saying, on top of that, the ways in which you have to grow to hit the next level are there. It's exponential. It really is exponential. And you never get to a point where you're like, that's good enough. You know, it's practice, practice, practice. You know, showing up as your best self each day is the hardest thing about it. Being consistent and just having to grind for your paycheck. I mean, you get real, real creative when you do, when you realize what everybody else is doing doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You see everybody online, you'll see all these mushroom farms, you'll see all these people maybe in your industry who are just doing it, and they fall out because that's what everyone else wants to do. And that's not the way that you're going to create this freedom for yourself, you know? So it's still stressful, you know, business will always be that way. You know, we're in agriculture. We're not making it huge quite yet, but we're doing well, and we're obtaining a lot of grants and a lot of funding. And we're slowly slipping into that research side of things where it's like most of our funding could be coming from grants and things like that, doing research in the field sooner than later. We're just waiting on confirmation on some real big ones. And once you cross that line into that research field, the money is nearly, I mean, it's there. It's
yeah.
there. You just need to have a decent grant writer, which is pretty dang easy these days. If you know what I mean? It's like,
no, I said earlier when you were talking about that, like you have these grant writers and the only way that they get money is if they get you the grant.
Yeah.
And I said in a comment stream while you were saying that, by the way, guys, if you're really good at stuff and learning how to write grants, and you know, you could probably move a lot quicker that today with utilizing AI tools and stuff. That's not a bad business to be in either, is the person that writes grants. One of the guys, I was just listening to a podcast. This guy's running a huge company, measuring their sales in hundreds of millions of dollars. That's the only thing they do is write grants for other people, and they're not exclusive to ag or anything either. In fact, I don't think they're in that space at all. They're more in the like NGOs and stuff like that. And so there's, when I look at the world, what most people see today and say is it's harder than it's ever been. And I'm like, well, if you try to use 1950 mindset in 2026, which is go to work, get a good job, work for 20 years, buy a house, have, you know, three kids, whatever. Yes, it is harder. If you'll come at 2026 with 2026 mindset, oh my God, the opportunities today. The problem is there's too many of them. You have to pick something and anchor down and go after it. When I think about like what I've been able to build, I've been doing this show 18 years. And when I started this show, and somebody would say, well, what do you do? I would say, I'm a podcaster. And you know what their first question was? What's a podcast?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, I don't know if you knew who Adam Curry is. Adam Curry's called the Podfather. He was the guy that got Apple to put podcasts in Apple Music.
Okay.
He was, before your time, back in the 80s, young man, he was a VJ on MTV when MTV played music.
Interesting. Right? Okay.
My podcast is only 6 months younger than his. I think the two of us together have the two longest continuous running shows. But when we started, people didn't even know what a podcast is. And then in that time, I've watched things like the gig economy. Like there was no Uber, there was no Lyft, there was no TaskRabbit, there was none of those things. There's so many ways to plug in income today. The key is picking something and going and doing it. And if it doesn't work out, well, what did you learn? And now what can you plug into next? And, you know, land ownership, that's the other thing about agriculture. Agriculture is not a food business. It is a real estate business that uses food to pay for the real estate. Right, it's Ray Kroc, like one of the largest operating company, the largest real estate holding operating company in the world. So there's bigger real estate companies, but an operating company that also has real estate is McDonald's.
Definitely,
right? Absolutely. So McDonald's is not in the freaking hamburger business. They're not in the chicken nugget business. They're in the real estate business.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's just a means by which. So the acclimation of assets is the key to wealth. And the key to wealth within assets has been real estate for as long as there's been such a thing as a title deed.
Yeah.
And so many people don't understand that.
Yeah, it just keeps appreciating. That's the thing about it. It's never going to go down, guys. It's just the way it is. Either everything's going to totally collapse.
Yeah.
And it'll be worth nothing and land is free for all. Or it's just never going to go down and it's always going to be worth more.
Yeah, and I know there's a guy out there right now shoving his glasses up going, well, actually, sometimes he doesn't mean in the next 6 months, folks. There are fluctuations in the prices of real property. And when they go down, by the way, it's the time to go get some. But the long macro, if you zoom out on prices and the value of land, it goes in one direction. And, you know, land is a limited thing. There is a finite amount of it. And then good land is even more finite. Like, yeah, you can get cheap land in New Mexico. Good luck with that. Not only is the land rough, but even if you put in like your indoor farm, you got to move the product to sell it, right? So there's a finite amount of land, and then there's an infinite amount of dollars until we change our economic system. Mm-hmm. So to me, appreciating assets have no top because fiat currency has no bottom. It's as simple as that. That doesn't mean there won't be some fluctuations in the middle. That's when we buy stuff if we're smart.
Yeah, it's a long game. It's a long game for sure. Yeah. But you know, like I was saying, if you can create equity somewhere by building a little homestead or just adding some sort of structure or two, there's lots of room to grow, you know. And for me, from someone who had nothing before I did this, super appealing, you know. There weren't any other ways I was going to acquire 70 acres other than this.
And now you can do things like throw a few Airbnbs on there over time if you want to. And that's another form of cash flow. And then you reappraise the property and that's more equity.
And that's exactly what we're doing.
It's like, you know, and could you have done what we're doing, talking about doing here 30 years ago? Yes. Is it actually easier to do now, though, in a lot of ways? if we don't just go, well, it's more expensive. We know that. That's what we already said, right? But from a tactical standpoint, it's actually easier to do today. There's more programs. There's more opportunities. There's more on-ramps. The markets have been developed. Like, I don't know that you could have made a lot of money as a specialty mushroom grower in 1995. The market hadn't been built yet. Now, for the right person, no market's a huge opportunity because you build the local market and you own it. But it's much easier to tie into something that now has mind share in the population. Like, if you ask the average person today, overall, are mushrooms good for you? Just that question. The average person with an IQ over 70 is like, yeah. Okay, so that's an opportunity that didn't even exist 30 years ago. Because the average person 30 years ago, like, mushrooms will kill you. Well, yeah, destroying Asia will kill the shit out of you. That's not what I asked you. Even when I think back to being a kid and foraging mushrooms, we didn't think we were doing anything for our health. It was just right. We were poor and we wanted food, and there's food grown out of the bottom of an oak tree. And by the way, whatever we can't eat, we can take that to the bar and sell it for $10 a pound. There was a local market economy in Schuylkill County for maitake. Like,
mm-hmm. Definitely.
We'd fill half a back of a pickup truck from one of the places we had, and we'd go around all the little corner bars with a scale on the bar selling for cash.
Right. And people would probably buy them immediately.
What's that?
People probably bought them immediately in these.
Oh, yeah, because since nobody was doing it commercially, that window was narrow. So when somebody found a windfall like that, you either bought it or, like, next week, it's not going to be – nobody's coming with another batch.
No. Right?
Like, you need to capitalize on that. And so there's always been ways to hustle, but now we can actually scale hustle.
Yeah.
That's what the gig economy is, and that's what with these programs for real estate are, is the ability to scale hustle. And that's just something that – I might need to write a book called Scale Hustle.
I love that.
You coach other farmers now. What is the biggest misconception? I think we're kind of tap dancing on that, so let's go ahead and hit that, that people have about getting started.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest misconception is that people think you need the land to start or you need the space. I mean, you need a closet. You need something. You need to start that ticker for the 3 years as soon as you possibly can. You know, and the way to do that is outfit a closet. Like you said, you have a boom room behind me. We have these little grow tents that all of our pro grow club members get. And there's so many ways to do it in such a low tech fashion just to get started. I mean, the key is starting. Get your timer started and start doing the work. Hopefully selling a little bit of mushrooms your first year. Like I said, the year in which we got this actual loan, we were only doing like maybe $60,000 a year. It wasn't a lot. And they were like, okay, this is good. And I was like, this is good, you know. Yeah. And they just want to know what you're going to do with the land, you know. And I'm like, I'm going to put a building up. I'm going to grow mushrooms. I might use some of the logs for shiitake. They're like, good enough, you know.
Yeah, and then the beauty of that is, since that was your plan and that's where your revenue already came from, then it was like whoever's making that final approval can look and go, well, can this scale? Yes. Does this person have experience doing this? Yes. Do they have existing revenue? Yes. If they scale, will they have more revenue? Yes. Their overall creditworthiness, like do they generally pay their bills? Yes. Stamp, move on, because that person making that decision is actually – more robotic in their response than somebody underwriting a loan to buy a conventional three-bedroom house, right? They have this checklist, and if the checks go in, then their job is literally to give that money to somebody.
Yeah.
And I know that's hard for some people to get their head around. There's literally people you are paid and judged on how much money you give out. You're also judged on how well you do that, like when you do it, did you make a good yes? But overall, that is their job. There's people that are in major corporations that are paid to hand out private grants, and they get in trouble if they don't give away all their money. And sometimes those people, you can't get money from them if you ask for too little because you're not worth their time. You ask them for $10,000, like, get out of here. Mm-hmm. I gotta do $30 million worth of grants. I'm gonna fight for your shit. Get out of here. Right? Like, that's something I learned when I started looking into grants. Like, there's public grants and there's private grants, and they have different ways that they're managed.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's so many. And the USDA essentially has things for people at all levels as well. So this is part of the farm coaching and what we're doing. We're getting people connected with these programs. And ultimately, our program Farm Launch is where we're starting, like I had mentioned, the A to Z mushroom farm start is, you know, 6 weeks to a fully scalable mushroom farm is the whole deal. And people just need to make that first investment. And the $300 can come from a FSA microloan, which is a super low, you know, super low investment. So essentially you can go take a microloan, which is like 5 or 6%. It's a 7-year term, up to $50,000. As long as you have an LLC registered, you can make your first investment to buy whatever to start growing, and you're off to the races. You know, it can all be financed, and that's exactly what we did. I had like the $300 was quickly turned into a microloan where we bought our first mixer, and then we were mixing stuff up, and then we started selling the substrate.
Yeah. And I mean, I learned when we helped build out a farm in West Virginia that the worst thing you can do actually is to spend your own money if you have it. It's just a terrible way to go. You're going to need it. And if you borrow money, you basically have tax-free cash flow, mm-hmm. which is a really interesting thing to look at. Because some things that like I ran more conventional businesses, and it's pretty simple to understand depreciation if my company buys a truck.
Yeah.
Depreciation on something like a pond or earthworks or a fence line is different in the agricultural world. What is depreciable, how long you have to depreciate it over. And if I spent your money to do it, I don't really care. But if I spent my money to do it, I care about the depreciation timeline. That's really kind of important to me because I no longer have the money, right? And I have this fence, and I just spent, you know, let's say $10,000 put this fence line in, and I spent that money this year, but I'm deducting that shit over 30 years and against revenue over 30 years instead of the revenue this year that I actually spent it against. And it's just a different world to operate in, and it changed my opinion of debt when we had that part of our lives back about 2014.
Yeah, the rules are totally different when it comes to ag. I mean – just to name a couple of other things that are doors that open once you get into agriculture, everything for the farm is tax exempt. So we don't pay taxes on any of our materials. When I built this building, we're not in like a, we're in a smaller rural community, not much of like a zoning board or anything like that. And we're actually agriculturally exempt. All of the build out, the only permit we actually had to get was a sewer permit. Everything else, I did the work myself, YouTube University, you know, going back to being able to hustle and do anything and everything. It's all out there. You know, you don't know how to fix an air conditioner. You YouTube it and you figure it out. And it's
yeah, like, there's the old saying back when I was a kid, like if you don't know how to do something, we didn't have YouTube, we didn't have internet. But they're like, if you don't know how to do something and your dad doesn't know how to do it, ask a farmer. Because they probably either they did it and they know how to do it, or they know another farmer who did it that knows how to do it, and they'll tell you who to go ask. Farmers have to figure shit out. I mean, what I found is some of the best, like the people that transition from I'm a worker bee with a job to being in the ag space, engineers, because they know how to build shit. They know how to figure shit out. They know how to fix shit, right? And they know how to design mm-hmm. systems. I mean, being a farmer is kind of like being a mechanic, being an engineer, being an accountant, being a supervisor. Like, you have to fill all those roles. But if somebody right now has a full-time job, no land, and they want to take a first step toward having what you have, what does that look like for them?
Yeah, the first step is just making the investment into growing something. You know, figure out what you like, what you want to do. But growing something, if you want to go the USDA route, is you have to be selling the agricultural products at least $1,000 a year. And there's who's to say that you couldn't maybe get 5-10 acres. You don't have to take the full 600,000. Maybe if you're doing 10,000 a year, they'll still give you 200,000 to buy a piece of property. But you just need to get growing, get an LLC formulated, get an EIN number, you know, just like starting a regular business, get an EIN number, check in with your local FSA, USDA office. These are the people that you want to make friends with, because they're going to send you grants. They're going to let you know if interest rates are changing. They're pretty much the people you want to talk to is the Farm Service Agency, which is a branch of the USDA. And just take your first steps, grow something, and figure out what your market looks like. Like you were saying, you know, New Mexico in the middle of nowhere. Sure, that's great. You can buy some land. But you actually have to have a business plan in action to make this work, you know. Yeah. So you need to think ahead a little bit. Okay,
who where's the product going? And from there, then the logistics would be, how do I make this thing shippable in a way that makes sense to the person who, whether I'm wholesaling or direct to consumer, how do I get this thing from this space out? Because there's a lot of things you can do that with. You can, there's things you could do with value add mushroom product that it doesn't matter where you make them. If there's a post office near you, you're in business, but there's places, other methods that's not so true for.
And I loved what you said about sticking to one thing, because this is something that I'm definitely guilty of. I think every entrepreneur is guilty of bouncing around between things. And that's like one of the biggest faults I see with these startups is people are trying to be a tincture company, a medicinal company, a fresh mushroom company all at once. You know, we actually don't really grow many fresh mushrooms anymore. We don't focus on the tinctures. Our thing is the wholesale and helping other farms, because you cannot do it all. You can't do all of the lab work, grow out the mushrooms, and do everything else. You need help, and you need to find people and be able to make this into something where it's standardized, so you can have employees doing it, so you're not doing all of the labor all the time. And that's what Farm Launch really helps farmers do, is like, you know, we're not thinking about this structured organization when we're starting our farms, but in reality, there needs to be an owner, there needs to be a manager, there needs to be these people in certain positions that are going to make it function like an actual company and not just you being the operator of everything. You know, the owner versus operator thing is huge for me. And that's been the last couple of years of my life, figuring out how can I be an owner of my company and work on building the company rather than operating in it and doing every single thing myself.
Yeah.
It's just the irony of small ag, man. That's just how it goes. You know, you want to do it all yourself, but
I mean, and that's true of like every business you could think of. When I was a teenager, one of my first real jobs where somebody paid me to do work, I worked for a dude, I shit you not, his name was Muskrat Purcell. I'm sure he had a God-given name. I don't know. Anybody could tell you what it was. He owned a junkyard. And his business was paying people for junk vehicles and selling parts, or selling off vehicles that he couldn't sell parts for. And you know what he hired me to do? Pull parts.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I was so young, I still didn't have a driver's license yet. I was like 15. I'm right up there on a bicycle every weekend, and he'd leave me a list. He wasn't even there, and I pulled the parts. You know what I never saw him do? Pull a part. When I stopped doing it, he hired one of my friends to do the job that I didn't want to do anymore, because that wasn't his job anymore. Now, I guarantee you, when he got started, that's what he did. He bootstrapped his business. He got a junk, worthless piece of land and figured out no one will yell at me and the EPA won't come in if I put junk cars here. And then he started that junk business, and he figured out how to monetize different aspects of it. And he hired to the requirement, even as, you know, basically a coal region redneck.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I mean, but he still had the mindset, that operator mindset, to run a business that way and go, I don't need to be doing this shit. I'll give some 15-year-old kid that wants money an opportunity. And if he doesn't work out, I'll just hire somebody else. And yeah, maybe I'll go do that if I have to. And I think honestly, he would have, if he couldn't find somebody to do the job I did, he would have just been like, come pull your own freaking part. I ain't going to do it for a fee anymore. Mm-hmm. The reason he would do the fee to pull the part was, I got somebody who'll do that. I can pay him X. I can charge Y. That's more money. I'm more likely to sell parts because customers are like when somebody will pull the part for you. So since it works, I'll do it. But I'm not – it's how do I do it without doing it? That's operator mindset. How do I set up a system that does it, whether it relies on automation, whether it relies on an employee, whether it relies on out-tasking, whatever, or contracting? How do I do it, make the money, and not actually have to do it?
Yeah, yeah, that's the name of the game, and that's why business is this ultimate self-growth journey, because you're finding your own worth every single day, you're figuring out, okay, where is my highest value task? And, you know, you have to believe that you're worthy of stepping up to that plate before anything's going to change. And then being able to lead people is a whole other subsect that I think we've lacked in the generations before in agriculture. You know, it was always the mom and the pops and his son. Yeah. And it's like, you know, pops wouldn't let the son touch the wrench until he was 51. And it's like a sad story. And now this guy's 50 and he doesn't even want the farm anymore because he's had no autonomy. So, you know, being a leader in agriculture it's imperative, I think, at this crossroads as to where we're at, where it's like things are going to either change drastically and these corporations are going to buy up all the land, or we're going to lead ourselves as people and use the government to get around the government.
That is an interesting thing you hit on there. Like, how old are you? I don't mean this in any.
No, yeah, I'm 34. Yeah,
34. So all you 34-year-olds who tell me I don't know what it's like, and you'll never own a house, quit bitching and go out and do something with your life. This guy did it, and he started a hell of a lot younger than 34, went out and did it. Nobody did it for him. Nobody handed it to him. He didn't inherit the land. His dad didn't have a trust fund set up for him. So there's a way to do that. But I think we might start to see a reverse on the age impact of farming. And what I'm thinking of is about 2014-ish, I spoke at a conference. Joel Salatin was at this conference as a speaker, too. And he said at that time, the average farmer in America was 66 years old.
And it's the same.
That hits on the farmer not teaching the kids and then wondering why the kids don't want the farm. Well, you sent them off to college. You sent them off to the city. You didn't teach them anything. You didn't hand anything down. They don't know how to farm. And by the time you're ready to retire, they're old enough to know what they don't know. Right. And they have a job in the tech sector or something making 120 a year. They don't want to come farm pigs.
No.
Of course they don't. Right. Like, and I think a lot of young people that have this farm fantasy it's a fantasy. They like
it is.
I've talked to more than a few people that run small to mid-sized farms that bring the woofers in and stuff, and they don't make it a week. The second they realize it's not about social justice, it's about work that they have to do. Right. And it's dirty and it's hard and it stinks and it's sweaty. I could make more money than this packing boxes in a warehouse. Well, then you should go do that. And they go off and do that.
Yeah. It's a passion project type of deal. You know, like there's got to be you have to have a real drive behind what you're doing. You know,
I call it grind to find, right? Like you have to grind through the hard to find where your passion lies. Because a lot of people say, well, I don't know what my passion is. Well, you ain't fucking done enough work yet.
No, exactly.
If you go out and do enough work, you'll find it sooner or later, you know. And on that, kind of wrapping up here, when you look at what you've built, what would you tell someone that feels like it's just out of reach for them? Especially, please speak to the people who are 25 years old right now, because I'm like, y'all assholes have a strong body, and you can go out and you can make things happen. I'm almost, you know, mid-50s now. Like, I can't do what I did when I was 25 anymore. I'm probably in better shape than most people in their 50s, but I ain't who I was at 28. I just am not that guy anymore. And so what would you tell that person that feels like it's out of their reach?
Well, it's funny that you said 25 because that's about when 10 Mile Mushrooms started.
Okay.
And at 23, I got clean off of heroin. So I literally had nothing.
Oh, wow.
At that
you had less than nothing. Let's be honest, right?
I had less than nothing. It was my fourth rehab, and I finally got my shit together enough, did the whole carny thing for a little bit, and then was looking to do something on my own because I always had that hustler mentality or whatever. But less than nothing. No credit, no money to start. There was no other real options other than start my own thing and bootstrap it. And I really – like just looking and walking the property, man, it blows me away that this is my life and that this is possible. And I just want to share that with as many freaking people as possible, because I know a lot of people are hurting out there and they are feeling like there's no way, but there is a way. It may not be the way that you thought. It may not be the conventional way, but the world is not conventional anymore.
Mm-mm.
The world plays dirty. And you got to step up to the plate if you want to make it happen. And it's totally doable. And you know, get yourself around the right people, get yourself around the right mentors, people who are going to show you the way. Don't think you're going to do it all on your own. I did that for like 7 or 8 years and it was not worth it. Since I've gotten a mentor and started working with them on a weekly basis, my life has changed drastically in so many ways. And you're going to become somebody that you never knew you would. And that's the most beautiful, beautiful part. And you might have some land with it, which, like, you can't beat it. You can't beat it. It's all doable, guys. Just expand your mind a little bit. Look around the corner. Look down the alley. Because the thing that you're looking for is there. It's just not in your field of vision at this very moment.
Yeah, definitely. Someone here is saying that testimony ought to shut a bunch of people up. But I disagree. It might help a few people that are on the edge. But this is my response to that. One would hope, but self-imposed victimhood has no limits. And I think there's a lot of people out there, they literally get angry when you offer them a solution because you've ruined their pity party.
Yeah.
Especially on social media where they post shit like, I'll never own a house. Or like when you're like, well, where do you live? Well, what's your budget? And then you throw them like 3 places on Zillow they could fix up and they start shrieking that it's not even livable. And why? Because it has laminate countertops. Like, yeah. What the hell are you talking about? I mean, good Lord. But that's, I figured out over the years, that's what the psychology is. I want to be miserable and I want people to commiserate with me and I want my excuses to be validated as reasons and you've ruined it. So now I have rage and it's a sad thing because, you know, it's not pure masochism that makes people do what you do and what I do. It's a desire to actually help.
Yeah. It's got to be.
Can we talk just a little bit before I got 2 questions for you from the audience, but how you actually like what your product really is. You know, I looked at your website today and you have these things called Master Bricks, first all in one commercial cultivation substrate solution. So you just said you don't grow a lot of fresh mushrooms anymore. What is it that you do that actually generates revenue for you now?
Yeah, so we're selling grow supplies and we're helping folks launch farms. So our main revenue stream is selling the bulk wholesale ready to fruit blocks that are ready to grow to these other farms. So they're colonized with mycelium. So this is a step back from that. You can see there's some blocks fruiting there. But these master bricks are an all-in-one substrate solution where you just add water to the bag and then it's ready to be actually sterilized. If you go to the commercial section there, you'll see the wholesale ready to fruit block section. And we do it all. We sell the grain spawn, we sell the substrate, we sell auger plates. So if you're working your way back from fruiting mushrooms to actually growing your own, we have all of the supplies that you would be needing to actually get that done. But cutting out all of that labor with the ready to fruit substrate is really where our company has shined. And now we're doing the Pro Grow Club. So we have this Pro Grow Club, which is pretty much a step down from our farm launch program. It's for home growers. It's for people who want to be in a community of cultivators. So it's a monthly, like I said, grow kit subscription where we meet once a month. We talk about growing. You get grow tents, all of the things you need to grow with the subscription. And we have our own community portal where we talk about growing, we hash things out. And like I said, you know, community is key. The mentorship stuff is key. So we're creating that kind of culture around the cultivation community.
Absolutely, man. It was very cool. The couple questions I have for you, one's pretty quick here, easy one. This was from Rachel, who's pretty close to you, by the way. I just realized where he is. Can we buy from him?
Yeah, absolutely. We're here at the farm all the time, pretty much Monday through Friday, 8 to 4. Somebody's here. I'm usually always here. But you're definitely welcome to stop by the farm. Just give us a call. We're on Google. And then obviously you can order grow kits, all of the other stuff on our website there. We don't have the Pro Grow Club or the farm launch things on the website yet. We're just slowly creating landing pages for that and getting people onboarded with that stuff. It's kind of a, they're new programs and we have so much interest in the Pro Grow Club. It's freaking awesome to see that beginners want this path, you know?
Sure.
But yeah, anyways, a viable option to buy from us. You can send us an email, you can order online, whatever suits your fancy.
Cool. And I wanted to kind of give you a nod on the blocks, the sterile ones. The idea there is actually very similar to like what soup companies did with condensed soup. Since yeah. you add the water, the weight's not as heavy, so it's cheaper to ship. And it also gives that grower control that you're not going to have any real concerns about mold or anything until you actually activate the block by moisturizing it. So I think yep. that's a really cool all around, just good business move there. And, but it sounds like your mainstay, if I'm not off, is the inoculated blocks, which if I was going to go into commercial production, especially before I got really systemized, that's what I would do, because I do believe that you should focus on the thing that will make your business the most money. And you're not going to be inoculating your own blocks at scale. You're going to have to hire employees anyway. So if I have a company set up to do pretty much that's their main thing they do, I'd rather hire a company than a person when I'm able to. Because companies have more than one person, and companies have policies, and companies have procedures, and companies fix shit when it's broken, and individuals just get drunk and don't come to work for 2 days. And you're like, well, I'll fire them. Yeah, but then you don't, you know, I can't tell you how many people that I held on to for like a couple extra weeks. Because I hadn't found somebody to replace. Like, they suck, but what would suck worse is if I had to do their job. So, mm-hmm. you know, I'm going to hang on to it. But with a company, like, that becomes their problem, finding good people and whatever. I just expect you to live up your service commitment.
Right.
And so if I'm scaling a business, and that's what now my customers expect that of me, my, you know, 20-odd restaurants that I'm supplying, they don't give a shit why Bill got drunk and why he's – been given a pass and why his girlfriend dumped him. All they care about is I ordered the shit. It's not here. Right. And now my menu can't be fulfilled. And the person that brought their friend in, who's a regular customer, is not going to be able to get their friend the signature mushroom thing we do. And now I'm pissed.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't want my customer feeling that way. So if I outsource part of the production, then I can fulfill my obligation to my customer, and I don't have to worry about that. And if I get to a point where I think, well, I can bring that in-house, well, I can transition to that, and that makes a hell of a lot more sense than to be the dude trying to get all the plates to spin and not fall off the sticks, right? I want to, like, spin one plate and deliver it to my customer, and I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, consistency is key. Consistency is way more of a key than even having funding in the beginning. Just yeah. being able to show up each week to those chefs and those restaurants and the farmers market and bring in revenue, it's tough. I mean, it's tough to learn all of these aspects of growing all at once. It's fun as a gig, as a hobby, but if you're going to try to make a living at it, you're going to have a lot of hard times really struggling trying to get to that point. And that's just been my experience. I know a lot of people who have been successful doing it from the beginning and doing the whole thing themselves. But, you know, my whole thing is, like, I don't think you've actually done the math on employees, on labor yeah. costs. Yeah. I don't think they have, because it's pretty apparent that it costs a lot more to have to hire and train people, like you're saying, and to have yeah. these bad people on board than it's ever worth. And yeah. that's mind, body, and spirit. That's everything, you know?
Yeah. I mean, as an author, I get a little pissed when I look at the way that Amazon KDP pays authors, but when I actually do the math and go, well, do I want to stock books in my house and ship them to people? The answer to that is no. And if I was going to go in that business and do it, how much would I charge? And the answer is more than they do.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just shut up and take my royalty check every month. Thank you. That's kind of how I feel about that business, you know, division of what I do. And I think there's a lot of value in being able to adopt that mindset. This one's more of a technical question from Amy. Is it possible to harvest chicken of the woods and use the mycelial propagation method and propagate more out of the wild? I had a really nice patch this spring.
That's a great question, Amy. So pretty much all of the strains that we're growing in the specialty mushroom industry are, in one way or another, most of them are directly from the wild. So they've been cultured. So what you can do with a wild mushroom is you can actually culture it onto an auger plate and then grow it out in a clean environment. Now you can do low tech methods and maybe try to shove some of the chicken in the woods and some trees that are dying that you think may work, but that's a little bit less reliable than the best way to do chicken is to actually plug logs with it and then bury the logs. Okay. Is the most ideal situation for chicken of the woods. They don't grow well indoors, cultivated. Mm. The yields are very small. They're not something that you're going to like sell as a business type of deal, which is what makes them so special. You know, between those and morels and some of the other wild ones, they're really tough to cultivate. So, you know, if you find them in the wild, it's possible. And there's tons of YouTube videos on there on culturing wild species. But you're going to have it's a long-term project for sure.
And we do have somebody asking where you're at. So I'm just going to real quick just pop up your little map right here. You can go by his website and see where he's at, folks. And it is 10 Mile Mushroom, 10milemushrooms.com. And you should be able to, guys, to remember that after so many years of hearing me talk about 9 Mile Farm. 10 Mile
that's
mushroom.
Great.
Yeah, that's kind of cool, man. And so the people can definitely get in contact with you through your website. I also have his Facebook, his YouTube, and his Instagram in the show notes, like I always do, folks. If you're listening to us live, if you're one of the 100-odd people here, great. And that just means if you click the link down there in the video notes right now, it won't go anywhere because we're not done yet. About maybe 30 to 45 minutes after we finish the live, which is coming real quick, if you click that link, you go over to my site and where I actually distribute the audio version of the podcast and all that stuff, all those resources and everything else that we talk about today will be there for you. Like it always is. So if you're in your car listening to the audio tomorrow or something, and you're like, I want to go check this out, don't worry. You don't have to stop, pull over, write it down. Just get on over to the Survival Podcast. And if you're listening in the future, 6 months from now or something, the search function, just stick in 3869 into the search box. That's the only thing you'll have to remember, and you'll be able to pull this episode up 10 years from now. You know, I think even if lightning strikes me or something, my wife will make sure this stuff stays up because it pays the bills. So you'd be good for a while on it. Hey, man, I really appreciate you being with us today, Kyle.
Yeah, thanks, Jack. It was an absolute pleasure. Appreciate you.
All right, folks, real quick, as we wrap up, I want to remind you of a couple things. One is when you shop online, if you'll use tspaz.com, where I do all my product reviews and everything, no matter what you buy, whether it's something I reviewed or not, you will be able to help us out. It won't take any extra cost or time or anything. You just will be helping us out because we are Amazon affiliates, among other things here. And today's item of the day is the same one I had yesterday because when I went out to get it, I couldn't find it. My wife found it for me today. Here's your fan dummy. I need it because I am going to be cooking steaks tonight. I'm going to be cooking some chuck steaks that I self-processed out of some primals. And this little fan here, I'll tell you, like one of the most famous chefs in the world told me about it on an airplane, except that he was on a Facebook reel or something like that. Alton Brown, I learned about this little fan from. I've always been a cook, and I've always liked to cook. And Alton was talking about how to make a steak, and he did the salt and the refrigerator trick that I've taught you guys for 15 years. I'm like, well, tell me something I don't know, Mr. TV Chef. And he said, I like to use a little fan like this and put it on the grate in the refrigerator and let it sit there for about 8 hours and get all nice and tacky and dry. And I'm like, that is freaking brilliant. So I actually ordered this fan sitting on an airplane at about 32,000 feet. And it was at my house the next day. They're about $13 and they're rechargeable. They use a USB port to charge and they're just kind of bulletproof. I mean, there's not much to go wrong with a product like this. And it actually helps cool you off, too. And it is portable, so it can go, you know, anywhere that you go. And a charge will last you between 6 and, like, 22 hours, depending on what speed you run at it. And a pretty good deal, as far as I'm concerned, at that price. And it's multifunctional. You can use it on your desk or whatever. I had a lot of people say that they've bought this and they're really happy with it, and they're not using it for cooking. And that's fine, too. It's just a great little tool. And think about, like, those grow tents or any place you might need some air circulation for your microgreens or something, it would have to be recharged. But, you know, like I said, it'll run a day on a charge on a low speed. Or if some of you guys with your biltong boxes or stuff like that, there's all kinds of ways that little fans can be used. So check these out. And remember, it doesn't matter what you buy, as long as you shop through tspaz.com, you will help us out. And then, you know, on that note, I wouldn't mind if you went through tspaz when you bought this. I don't really care how you get to the point where you're going to buy it. If you would be so kind as to pick up a copy of my latest books, if you haven't done so yet, Laws of Life, Book 2, Now Build the System for Your Life. I poured a lot of effort into this. I released the first book in the series in the summer last year. It made three different Amazon bestsellers list. I released this, and we had the second edition of that first book and this book simultaneously on a bestsellers list with, you know, books out of like publishers like Simon and Schuster and stuff like that. So we've been able to really make a splash with this book. And the one thing I need now, though, because it's a brand new book, I need reviews. So if you already like, Jack, I already bought it, please go by Amazon and leave me a review. Even if you think it sucks, go ahead and leave me a review that says it sucks. I'm not just fishing for the positive reviews. It really helps us reach more people when we get a product like that reviewed. And I am working diligently on the workbooks that go along with these two books. Those should be out, one probably this month and the second one in August. And then we will turn to the next book on AI, which will be called Me, Myself, and AI. Thank you to Tim, who fed that title to me in one of these live streams. Anyway, with that, guys, I appreciate you being here today. Tomorrow, remember, we will not have a live. Tomorrow's an expert counsel Q&A show for the week where our expert counsel answers your questions. If you want to ask our expert counsels a question, send me an email, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, TSPC in the subject line. Tell me which expert you are asking the question. Give me the question, then give me the details. The question should be one sentence. Then we know what you're asking, and so do you, and so does the expert. We'll have that show tomorrow. I've got a great amount of content from the council right now. If you're like, well, who's on the council? TheSurvivalPodcast.com. Go to the About tab, meet the expert council. You'll see all the great people that we have answer your questions. And with that, take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with that other episode. Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you to. Make your own way, the others will follow. The revolution.